Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Migration Policy Institute. I'm Dimitri Papadimitriou, and it is my distinct pleasure and a personal privilege to welcome to the Institute Ali Mansour, who is the Minister or Secretary of Finance in Mauritius and has held senior appointments in a large number of important bodies, the World Bank, IMF, the European Union, et cetera, et cetera. And I've had the privilege of knowing Ali when he was working on a migration book. But I found out that it was 6.5 years ago, and I'm saying to myself, wow, how time passes. The topic of today's conversation is the Global Forum in 2012 edition of the Global Forum on Migration and Development. And I suspect that you're here, and not because you're trying to, only because you're trying to avoid the 500-degree temperature outside, but because you know something about the Global Forum and you're interested in finding out what this year's edition is going to be like. Ali will tell us some of his goals for the forum and, you know, some of his aspirations and where the planning stands and anything else, of course, that he wishes to do. We have been at the Migration Policy Institute. We have been engaged with the Global Forum since its inception, since the high-level dialogue that took place about 5 or 6 years ago. As you know, Kathleen Newland, my colleague who actually heads the migration development and refugee issues here at the Migration Policy Institute, has been engaged on the issue of migration and development since probably around 2003. Kathleen is in Europe as we speak, having just released a book on the diaspora handbook that I think you see somewhere outside perhaps, and in Brussels, and she's going to be coming back this weekend, so I am simply subbing for Kathleen, if you will. The handbook I'm referring to is titled Developing a Roadmap for Engaging Diasporas in Development. And it is available for download at www.thediasporahandbook.org. It is a practical guide that was commissioned by the governments of the Netherlands and Switzerland within the framework of the Platform for Partnerships, a Global Forum for Migration and Development sponsored tool to facilitate knowledge sharing. For those of you who are interested in that specific component of the topic, on Tuesday, June 26th at 10:30 p.m., there will be a presentation, I'm sorry, a.m., thank you. Maybe we'll make it an evening event, who knows? There will be the formal presentation of the Diaspora Handbook here at MPI, and it's going to be Kathleen Newland and IOM's Director General, Bill Swing. So keep that. We've already advertised it, and keep it in mind, and we'd love to have you back for that event. Please know that this event is live-streamed, so that means several things. It means that Ali and I will have to behave, which at least 50% of us may have a problem with, but my colleagues always tell me to try my best. It also means that when you ask questions, you need to wait for the microphone to get to you because, you know, after the event, all of the Q's and A's will also be put up on the web. So, two words about the Global Forum on Migration and Development. It was an effort to try to make progress on a very difficult issue for advanced industrial societies, but also a very consequential issue for the rest of the world, and trying to sort of break down some of the difficulties, some of the sort of the borders, if you will, allegorically speaking, that have kept, sending and receiving societies at, in a sense, at different parts of the equation on this particular issue. About 160, 70, 80 countries participate in the Global Forum, which is a very large number of countries, and, you know, the, 80 or 90% of the world's countries. And there are some innovations that Ali will tell us about that he's trying to make. This will be the last Global Forum prior to a conversation that that will take place at the United Nations next year, which would be the second higher-level dialogue that will essentially evaluate, you know, the progress that has been made as a result of the Global Forum and decide on what it is that they should move forward with. Please note that this is not a UN initiative. This is an intergovernmental initiative. It is governments that decide, you know, how to move forward, that chair the event. And this year's chair of the event is Ali Mansour. Ali, the floor is yours. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and thanks to MPI for organizing this, and we appreciate all of you having an interest in coming. We hope there'll be a little bit of homework for some of you which comes at the end of this conversation, but so we're therefore glad that you're here. Before we get into the subject matter, let me tell you two little stories to perhaps situate our thinking. The first one is of a couple who had been married 50 years and decided to go out and celebrate. And at the end of the evening, a fairy showed up and said, you know, it's so touching, especially nowadays, to see people in love after so long. I had to come and offer each of your wish. And the wife, without hesitating, said, I've always wanted to go on a cruise around the world with my husband. No sooner asked, no sooner executed. Two tickets, first class, Queen Mary around the world. The husband had a little bit more hesitation, and then he thought to himself, I'm not going to get a chance like this again. And he said, sorry, dear, but I'd like to have a wife who's 25 years younger than I am. And instantly, he turned 97. So the two morals from this story is, first, remember that fairies are ladies, but more importantly for what we're going to say today, you need to be very careful what you wish for. And I think in the field of migration, we need to be very careful, especially when it comes to civil society, be very careful what you ask governments to do. And we'll come back to that later. The other one is a story of a king who was told there was a very smart man in a faraway village whom he had to bring to court to be an advisor. And he did so. And the first day when the advisor came, there was some wonderful eggplant which the king appreciated, and the advisor said, Your Majesty, you're right. Eggplant is the best vegetable in the world. Do you see how rich it is in color, all the nice minerals? We should eat it every day. So after 2 weeks of eating eggplant every day, the king said, I never want to see eggplant again. And the advisor said, Your Majesty, you're absolutely right. I think we should ban this in the kingdom. Do you think this deep purple color must be toxic? So the king said, I'm a little bit puzzled. Aren't you the one who 2 weeks ago told me it's the best vegetable in the world? Yes, Your Majesty. Do you want me to be loyal to you or to the eggplant? And today I think we need to be loyal to the eggplant, and I'll try to be, especially in dealing with the questions you asked, because migration, again, is an area full of emotion. If you look at the EU, which has a well-functioning internal market, the one area where the market doesn't function fully is labor movement. Eastern European countries still do not have access. And those countries which had opened up borders with the Schengen Agreement are talking about undoing what they did. So we're dealing with an area where, as one German policymaker said, we thought we were getting labor, we ended up getting people. And this is an area where we are dealing with people, and we need to remember this. At the end of the day, it's about people. But because it's about people, a lot of emotions come in, which makes this a very difficult area of policy to make progress. So that's general background. I think you have a general understanding of the GFMD, and if you have questions, I'd rather answer them later, so we can focus on substantive issues. Now, the substantive issues, unfortunately, are going to be more process at this stage, but I think that those of you who have an interest in the areas we are going to focus on this year can help the process become substantive over the coming years, and this is the homework which I was trying to assign at the beginning. This is the first time that an African country is chairing the GFMD, and by tradition the GFMD alternates between an industrialized country and a developing country. Switzerland was the last chair, and Sweden will be the next one. And because Mauritius is an African country, we thought we should try to make a big effort to develop an African agenda. The African voice has been fairly loud at the first GFMD in Belgium about 6 years ago, but since then it has been muted. Largely because Africans don't have the resources to, on a continual basis, make this a priority area. On the other hand, it's a great pity. First, 80% of Africans in West Africa who are migrants in Africa, not outside Africa. And while the proportion is slightly less in the rest of Africa, the majority of migrants is still in Africa rather than outside. Second, all the major regional organizations, ECOWAS, SADC, COMESA, have protocols on the free movement of people, but unlike Europe, where they are gradually implemented, here, to my knowledge, no country has ratified and is implementing any of these. And this is partly because these are probably far too liberal given the sensitivities involved. But between doing nothing and doing everything, there is a middle ground of gradually getting there. So we think this is an important part of the African agenda. Can we try to make progress? And if we go back, we're talking about human beings. We're talking about human welfare of individuals. If those who were illegally in South Africa, and I take South Africa only because it's a very large country, could be given the status that they ought to be given if there was a common market, the improvement in human welfare would be quite big. Of course, it's very unlikely we will get there in one day and through the stroke of a pen. So one must try to think, are there ways of getting there more gently? So this is one part of the African agenda. Can we try to develop a multi-annual program? And because of the difficulties in Africa of mobilizing resources to support this, it will need support from the rest of the world. And the lesson that we're taking is from Eastern Europe. It's a thought experiment for you. When the wall fell, most people thought the prospect for reform in Ukraine was better than in Romania. In fact, Romania has moved much further with reform than Ukraine, and we argue that part of the reason for this is you need to spend a lot of political capital if you dismantle barriers, and you need to regenerate it. Those countries on the EU track, membership track, had access to the cohesion fund. Dedicated, predictable, additional support, financial support to government, so they could either spend to build political capital with groups who would be affected by removal of barriers, or spend it on other groups to generate broad support, so that even if the groups who were affected shouted, the rest of the population would drown them out. And it's a little bit of a combination of the two, and each government, of course, has to decide how to spend its political capital to get the biggest impact. But the key thing is, if you do not have these additional resources, it's very hard to do. And this is, I think, a large reason why Ukraine is, in fact, much further behind reform. So people talk of political will, but political will doesn't come from God, and it doesn't fall from the sky. It's generated. Obviously, money is not going to make people who don't want to reform reform. But reformers who do want to reform must be given the means to carry the day by having tools to generate political capital. And benefits of liberalization are there, but they come in the long-term spread over time. Whereas in the case of spending the capital, it's immediate. a small lobby group is immediately and vociferously opposed. And this, I think, also explains the big difficulty of migration policy reform that both President Bush and President Obama wanted to try in the U.S. but found very difficult to do. The benefits are spread over a large number of people over time. Nobody cares strongly enough to go in the streets, whereas those who don't want it are very vociferous and very organized. So you need a mechanism to build political capital to be able to deal with that. So we are trying to develop a program where African countries will take commitment for serious and meaningful reform, but like in Eastern Europe, it will need support from the international community to make it happen. And this is the major item that we are trying to focus on that view. Obviously, the GFMD has many programs, and MPI has been involved with them from the beginning and has done good work, which I think is widely appreciated, for which, again, thanks on behalf of the forum.
And I accept it on behalf of my colleagues.
but if we're looking for what is specific to the chairmanship of Mauritius this year as an African country, it's to try to bring this African element and to see whether we can begin to make some real progress in improving individual welfare in Africa. The second thing, which just to situate, we have worked very hard to try to get stronger African involvement in the leadership of the forum. And we're very pleased that out of 6 roundtables, 5 of them are co-chaired by African countries. And what we would like to see is a link between the work in these roundtables coming back into developing an African agenda. I come fresh from a meeting in Mauritius a week ago where we actually had 3 meetings one after another. One was a meeting organized by the Swiss and UNDP on mainstreaming migration into development planning. And the second one was organized by the World Bank on mobilizing resources of the African diaspora. The handbook of MPI comes at a good time for that. And the third one is we brought the African countries that had come to these meetings together to say, would there be an interest in forging the type of multi-annual program that I was just mentioning? And the good news is Mali, Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, Ethiopia have agreed to join with Mauritius to try to see whether we could put such a program together. And next week we plan to go to the EU to start seeing whether they would be willing to support such a program. Now, these are very early days. We are more process than substance at this stage. And between people saying in principle they are interested, after all, both President Bush and President Obama were more than in principle interested but couldn't get reform through. So between being interested and doing it, there's a gap. But this is where I think civil society comes in, that first of all, we're dealing with areas which are so difficult that governments alone cannot do this. Governments will only do this if they can mobilize the support of civil society to overcome lobbies that oppose change, as well as to do the technical and research work required to build the case for change. And then, more importantly, many of the interventions involving migrants, governments are not well set up to deliver the required services. So the collaboration with civil society is crucial. The collaboration with the private sector is equally crucial. And what we would like to see going forward is a coalition between interested governments, civil society, and the private sector, focused always on the question, are we doing things which will improve the welfare of individual human beings? That, I think, has to be the metric. And the judgment of whether we succeed or not must be not how many meetings we had or how many papers were produced, but how many people's lives have been improved, even if it's 100 people. 100 is better than none. And better 100 that we achieve than trying to do 1 million and we fail because it's overambitious. So I said you need to be careful what you wish for. We need to calibrate this right if we want to make progress. But we can make incremental progress and gradually build on it. And what we have suggested is let's use the existing protocols as a baseline. And this is where I think MPI in particular can help us on the intellectual side of this, whether the model we're saying is workable and how. But what we are saying is we want to avoid a spaghetti bowl. The reality is, unlike Europe, no sovereignty has been transferred to any regional economic community secretariat. The EU has powers. The EU Commission has powers. Some people in some countries think too much, but they do have powers. None of the African regional organizations has any power, which means all the action will have to be bilateral between interested countries. But what we've suggested, taking these six as a pilot on which we can build, it's an open, we're not excluding other countries that want to come in, but we need to start somewhere. So the six countries, the idea is it'll be a series of bilateral arrangements, but on an MFN, most favored nation basis, which means if Mauritius and Kenya agree on something, whatever they agree amongst themselves is automatically extended to Nigeria if Nigeria is willing to also reciprocate. And if we use, we look at what's in the protocol and we gradually make progress towards what's in the protocol, it means we will all be working towards the protocol eventually taking hold. And when enough countries have made enough progress, you may then go back to the multilateral through the protocol. And we hope this is a way of bridging the gap between where we need to go and how to get there. But I think some intellectual thought from MPI and other researchers here would be helpful to see whether this is workable and how to make it happen. I also want to talk a little bit about the Caribbean. Mauritius belongs to the African, Caribbean, Pacific group of countries, which essentially, let's call a spade to be loyal to the eggplant, the former colonies of Europe. Of course, independence is so long ago, I think, it's a little bit like the story of the gentleman who went to see a psychiatrist, explained all the terrible things his parents had done to him when he was a child, and how his life had been totally messed up as a result, and asked the psychiatrist, is it true that it's entirely the fault of my parents that I'm this messed up? And the psychiatrist said, you're 100% right, it's entirely the fault of your parents, but if you remain that way, you're a bloody fool. So the issue is, this is a grouping of former colonies, but I think we are beyond this. We've been long enough independent that we need to assume responsibility for our successes and failures. And the point, though, is that this group does function as a partner to the EU, and we want to build on that partnership. What we would like is to see whether in the Caribbean and the Pacific, a similar effort to what we're doing in Africa could be mounted. And I was just in Jamaica before coming here. Jamaica has been active, which is one reason we talked to Jamaica in the GFMD. And we have asked Jamaica whether they would be willing to try to see if there's enough interest in the Caribbean to do something similar as in Africa. Now, what they would do would not necessarily be exactly the same in content. In fact, in many ways, we in Africa need to learn from what CARICOM has already achieved. But the point is, if we can get something in Africa, something in the Caribbean, and we hope that we may find a Pacific country, that we can make this approach a little bit more global. And again, to the extent that some of you here have contacts in the Caribbean, the Pacific, of course, we welcome the African contacts too to help us, but can we try to push this thing forward more globally? Now, Mauritius is chair only for a year. Our chairmanship is almost over. Before we have achieved anything, it will be over. But remembering a quote from the time of the controversy when George Bush became president, a legal scholar said that he found it very difficult to understand how the Supreme Court could give more importance to arbitrary dates than to meaningful votes. And in the same spirit, I think we shouldn't be hung up by arbitrary dates over meaningful action. Mauritius happens to be chairman of the GFMD from one date to another, but the problems of individual human beings whose lives could be improved and are not because policy is failing them is a problem which was there before we took over. It's a problem which will be there after we take over. We hope the other African countries that have stepped forward, and Jamaica and others that make a step forward in the Caribbean and Pacific, we have an interest in making things better. We can't do it alone. We can't do it without the development partners, but we can't do it without civil society and the private sector. So what we hope is we'll launch a process this year, but with your help, let's keep working on it. And what we would like is by November, we have the outline of a multi-annual program, at least for Africa, hopefully for other regions. Mauritius is a very small country. We have 1.3 million people, and we're a middle-income country. So we do not have the resources that the Swiss or the Swedes have at their disposal, or we would be able to do more globally. But we do count on igniting interest by others like Jamaica, and if you can help ignite interest elsewhere, we will certainly like to nurture this year to the extent possible, and then next year, let's see if we can make these things take their own course with your help, and we obviously would be interested in carrying on with the agenda for the coming year. So in a nutshell, this is, I think, what we're trying to do this year, with one other twist that I will leave you with, and then we'll take questions to deal with issues that may be of interest to you, and hopefully to see how you may help us advance this agenda if you think it's worth it. But we have also tried to push very hard that there should be more involvement of civil society and the private sector in the forum. We find it a little bit odd that countries which have much stronger governance structures than Mauritius and which are much wealthier and much better established than Mauritius seem to be nervous about involving the private sector and civil society in the dialogue, and we think this is a great pity. Our own experience at home is that we have been able to make a lot of progress only because government has worked in collaboration with its social partners. And we think that this is true for others as well. Now, this is a state-led process. It's also a voluntary process. So we're certainly not advocating that there must be rules or one size fits all. But we think space needs to be given. We very much welcome the common space, but where exactly there is space which has been created for a dialogue between governments and civil society and the private sector. But we don't believe that this is being used strongly enough with a clear focus that carries on beyond the particular chairmanship that is there. So we are trying to make sure that this year the common space could have more meaning both in terms of impact as well as reach over time by being linked to this multi-annual dialogue for Africa and we hope the Caribbean and the Pacific. And again, we hope that you can help us seize the ground and fill the space. Thanks very much, and let me leave it to you now to see if you have any issues or questions that you want to raise.
Thank you, Ali, for this compelling and eloquent presentation, and thank you for the jokes. You know, I just wrote the first one down. You know, I'm terrible at that, but that is a heck of a joke. But if I may formulate your own comments and questions, and then I'll open it for a conversation, a dialogue. I am personally tangentially involved, engaged with Global Forum, as I implied earlier. My only sort of engagement with it was when my country of birth hosted, I don't know, number three or number four, and I was asked or drafted or whatever, to lend a hand, and an entire team of MPI people actually went to Athens. And the preparation of that forum And there is, you know, a connection to my story to what it is that Ali was saying. We try to do the two things that he's trying to do. Engage the business community, private sector. We held a small meeting of about 30. That's all we could do. That's all the interest we could muster among European and American business people in Athens a couple of months before the Global Forum. And some of these people stayed on with the forum for another year or so, and then they just sort of went away. It suggests how difficult it is to engage the business community in these big global events. And, you know, Lynn Shotwell, who will probably say something, you know, was involved in that. And, you know, we all have some ideas as to why, you know, the business community doesn't really want to play a central role in that. And we can discuss this in the Q&A part of it. But the civil society has been there since the beginning. You know, it was the first year, the first time that the Global Forum met under the chairmanship of Belgium. It was also the first attempt on the part of both civil society to engage the issue and governments to both bring civil society in, but in typical governmental fashion, keep civil society at best at arm's length. And ever since then, civil society has an event that precedes the Global Forum for a couple of days. Monday, Tuesday, typically, the forum, the state-led forum takes place, you know, typically Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And the one event that I attended, so I can say a single observation doesn't mean all that much, but there are colleagues of mine here from the Institute and elsewhere. What I understood then and what I am told is that, you know, civil society does participate, does make demands. There are fairly significant divisions within civil society as to what it is that they should ask the governments to do. And the best that has happened is some sort of a, before the actual meetings, some sort of a meeting where civil society and a subgroup, a small group of the state meets together and the one listens to the other. So I am curious, Ali, whether, you know, you have something else, a different idea as to how to bring the civil society in, number one. And number two, whether you are doing something specific that will bring the private sector directly and engage it directly into the conversation. So
let me try to answer these two questions. I'll start with the civil society. First of all, just because we try to do things doesn't mean they will work. So it is possible that things we try will not work. And again, if there are good ideas that we are not trying, or improvement to the things we propose, this is part of the reason to have this dialogue with you. And obviously, things you say here, we will take note of. But if you have ideas later, I hope you will also pass them on to us. There is a GFMD website where you can send stuff, or you may find it more efficient, if the MPI doesn't mind, to route things through MPI. And the whole point is to have your input. And I think this is one thing which I hope may be a little bit different, that we are trying to more actively and proactively engage with civil society. So that may be something which makes a difference. The second, which is more substantive, we're saying there must be some discipline. And if you, I think you've said it well. In civil society, which after all reflects all our societies are like that. I'm sure even in very regimented societies like North Korea, although the voices may be more muted, there are always a huge range of opinions. And there are some people who are very strident and interested in being stranded on the dry rock of principle, but making their point, and others who like to find common ground so you can move forward. So Those who just want to be strident, I don't think it'll be easy for us to work with, and it won't be easy for any government to work with. On the other hand, there are many voices in civil society that would like to have a constructive role. And a constructive role means compromise, and compromise, as you probably know, has been defined as something which nobody likes, but everybody can live with. So this is, I think, what we're trying to do, and we're putting a metric. The metric is, let's find things which will make a difference to individual human beings' lives. It's no use working on issues which won't, but then it must also be issues where there is some scope to have progress. There are many things in our own lives. We all say we want to go to heaven, and we all know what is required to go to heaven, but very few of us are able to every day do the things we know will take us to heaven. We hope a few little deviations won't matter, and I think it's the same with countries, it's the same with governments. There are things that people would like to do, and for various reasons they're not able to do. And practical people need to sort of operate saying the world is imperfect, and we have to work within these imperfections. So those who are willing to do that and engage government say what's desirable, but then what are the compromises which are worth doing so that we can move forward, but we haven't given up so much that nobody's life is being improved. This is, I think, where we hope we can make more progress by getting those parts of civil society that are willing to enter the tent and be part of the solution to do so. It does mean not everyone will enter. It also means not all governments will be part of this. And we've trying to suggest two metrics. First, governments are accountable. When you have elections with a landslide, very rarely is a landslide more than 52%, which means 48% disagree. So you can have large numbers of people being very vociferous. It doesn't mean in a democratic process their view would prevail. So civil society is not accountable. We don't know. We've just had an election in France, and we are likely to have an election in the US where there have been very sharp differences of opinion over which way the country should go. But at the end, only one view will prevail. And that's why governments are the ones that have to be accountable. And at the end, it's governments who have to decide, because they do go and seek a mandate. Civil society does not. It's easy for me to scream whatever I like and claim this is the right thing. But if I can't convince a majority to follow me, it's not operationally useful. So the metric which we're saying is people have to accept at the end of the day, it's governments which more and more across the world, and almost all those that will be working with us, all the ones I said in Africa, I think, fit the bill. Certainly Jamaica does. So we're talking about governments which are accountable to their people in a meaningful way. So therefore, you have to defer that it's the government that's accountable that's going to have to decide the agenda in the final analysis. But we say to the government, once you've decided the agenda, if you think you can do this without civil society, you're likely to fail. So, two parts. Let government say, these are the things we'd like to do, and then let's see how civil society can help us. But civil society can also be a partner, say, look, these are things we'd like you to do, and try to convince the government. Where it can convince the government, so much the better, but where it can't, it has to accept that it will work within the boundaries that the government that is accountable sets. And again, I hope that this is something a little bit different, but as I said, between what we were trying to do and succeeding, there's a big gap and we may fail. And I think you're right, this is a very difficult area. For the private sector has no time to waste in meetings, unless these meetings are going to lead to them improving their bottom line. Now, again, businesses can be strategic, and often enough of them are that we can engage. They know that sometimes you have to invest your time and effort and your money to be able to get a result over time. You might cost something today, but they are not going to invest unless they think there's a good likelihood of something coming which improves the situation in which they're operating so that they can make more money. And let's be blunt. Again, I want to be loyal to the eggplant here. Businesses are not philanthropic enterprises. They are there to make profit, but we find that if governments regulate them properly and if there's a framework, and most of them recognize increasingly that they want to make money, but they can't make money if the society around them is collapsing, so they have some social responsibility too. And I think most are willing to situate themselves in a social context. So between government regulation and corporate social responsibility, there is room for a constructive engagement with private sector, but it must be things where the private sector is improving in the end its bottom line. But improving its bottom line may involve investment in human beings, which is not happening now. It's not in the interest of the private sector that the people they hire are illegal, that their kids can't go to school, that they don't have access to health care, that they could be deported at any time, that they can't be given the training they need because they are not allowed into the institutions that do so. So I think there's a host of areas, and we are focusing on labor mobility and skill as areas we think triple win. If I'm a migrant in a country and I'm cut off from services, including improving my skill, and I get this, my welfare goes up, my wages go up, my family's better off, I have more security and peace of mind. The employer gains, he has a more productive worker who's less tense, less worried, less under stress, and more focused on performance. And the country gains, the government gains, because you have a situation which unlocks more growth and more social stability than if you pretend that these people are not there. Having said that, we know there are a lot of emotional barriers to the rationality. I'm giving a very rational approach to it, and rationality banks straight into emotion, which block a lot of action in this area. But if the challenge is this, the age of reason triumphs over obscurantism. Can we bring reason to triumph over our emotions here? Can we understand the emotions and find a way of working with them gently and letting reason gradually take hold? Maybe not. And I don't want to criticize too much things which happen around the world, but some things I think have to be remarked on. When serious presidential candidates in a serious country can publicly say that prayer is the answer to policy problems, and this is accepted by large amounts, this shows you the challenge. But if even in a country as advanced as the U.S., emotion can triumph over reason, and to the extent that a serious scientific commentator has to write in Newsweek about this, so I'll hide behind the king here, the eggplant, and attribute it to somebody else. But I'm saying this not to make a comment on the U.S., but to make a comment about the human condition and the challenge. That there's a lot of emotion which we have to overcome with reason. Hopefully we can. But you pointed out challenges are tough, and the private sector will only come in if they think there's a reasonable process where the things which matter to them will be dealt with. But this is what collectively we hope we can, with your help, set the basis this year using the common space and other devices to make things happen.
Thank you again. I will open it to questions, first to discuss the issue of a more effective engagement of civil society and the private sector. But also, something else that I don't want to lose from what Ali said, namely the issue, you know, the organization of subgroups, in a sense splitting the difference between large multilateralism and bilateralism on these issues. You know, Moisés Naím coined, I think he may have coined it, a wonderful term. He calls it minilateralism. You know, so the six countries that you're talking about, you know, fit in that definition. And expanding into the Caribbean and elsewhere, of course, you know, would make for an interesting trans-regional conversation on these issues. The lady in the back, please identify yourselves and again, speak into the microphone.
Hi. Thank you, Chair. Those are very interesting remarks and MPI as well. My name is Ana Vendano. I am the Director of Immigration for the AFL-CIO, and I've participated in the GFMD. I couldn't make it to Switzerland last year, but all the others. Chair, I'm curious, where do trade unions, that your analysis was very thorough and very interesting, and I'm curious, where do trade unions fit in that analysis?
And I've given are clearly a part of civil society, and trade unions have an important role to play in the process. Now, that role, I think, will depend also on the country context, but certainly when we say civil society, it has to be a broad tent and not a narrow tent. The limiting factor is who are those who want to come and make compromises versus those who want to sort of make speeches and say, stranded on the dry rock of principle. But that is a self-selection exercise. We want a very open tent, and of course we'd like as few people to remain on that dry rock and as many people at the table trying to find practical solutions. But again, we are only talking about what is desirable. Whether we can make this work is still an open question.
Thank you.
But do you have any specifics that where you think you could help us? Agenda move forward.
I appreciate that. We've participated in every global forum, and we've had a good contingency there, and I think that we've contributed to the conversation. Sharon Burrow was actually the chair in Manila. I just was curious because your analysis mentioned civil society going from government regulation to corporate social responsibility, and trade unions don't quite fit into that model, but thank you, I appreciate your remarks.
Well, if you allow me, because this is an important issue, the reason I single out business is business has a particular role. We are talking about human beings, but we're also talking about labor, and labor is hired by the private sector. So employers have a particular interest which is peculiar to their role. The rest of civil society is much more diverse. It doesn't mean that it's not equally important. But government is the regulator. Business is the provider of jobs. And civil society, including trade unions, has the responsibility to make these pieces fit in a way which enhances human welfare. In fact, this is a role if you allow me to talk for you and disagree, if you think I'm wrong, this is the primary role of trade unions, to make sure that workers get a fair deal.
Hard to disagree with that. The gentleman back there.
I'm Elliot Roper, and I'm actually with Cisco Systems, the private sector. So, however, when it comes to government and policy, immigration is what I studied in graduate school. So to that end, when you're talking about civil society, one of the things, I know you were asking kind of for suggestions. What I did my thesis on in graduate school was, I ended up using a lot of NGOs as part of civil society for conducting my own research. Everything from refugees to asylum seekers to laborers coming across borders, primarily in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. But I also wondered if you would be able to kind of expand on, more specifically, civil society is a broad concept, a broad subject. What specifically within civil society would you use to shed more light on the issues that we're discussing?
I deliberately use the word civil society and don't break it down, because unions are clearly part of it, NGOs are part of it, but we can also have much more informal groups. Sometimes you have neighborhood groups or social or cultural associations. And again, one way to think about it, and again, we're open to broadening the analytical framework we're using, is we're looking at in terms of policy, what are the main interests. Government has a clear interest. It's responsible for society's welfare as a whole, and it's there with a monopoly to make regulations. Business is there because they are the place where migrants are employed. And then the rest we lump together, because the rest is much harder to define specifically in terms of generic role. And I think the specific role will depend on the specific programs we're looking at. But many of these things, if you want outreach for immigrants, one of the things that our Minister of Labor has said, and I hope we'll make some progress on that ourselves, is he would like to improve the housing of migrants in Mauritius. We have rules, we have regulations, but they're not necessarily adhered to. Now, one solution is turn the government into a policeman and hire a government employee or even a police officer and post him in every house in the country and make sure that everybody gets decent housing. Even if this were feasible, I'm not sure it would be desirable from the point of view of civil liberties. A much better way, I think, would be to work with civil society organizations that are concerned with the welfare of migrants and have them work with the migrants and then try to have a more collaborative partnership with employers saying, look, there are rules, you're not complying, we can help you to comply with these rules. But for the recalcitrant to come to government and say, look, here the rules are not being followed, you may want to use a bit of the stick. I'm giving a concrete example, but not necessarily the most important one.
Thank you. Did you? Who is the? Okay, this gentleman, and then you're next.
Okay. Hi. My name is Jean Boucher. I'm a sociology PhD student at George Mason. I also spent 8 years on the U.S.-Mexico border working with immigrants. I have two questions, if I might. Number one, how are you assessing whether someone's life is improved? And number two, I guess to try to get to a fundamental and to bust things open a little bit, looking at the future, I see migration as a symptom. So whether economic inequality or as we're looking at climate change now, and I know climate change is becoming really a security issue because in some ways it seems like we've missed the bus on climate change. So I guess looking forward, what's able to be done about things like economic inequality and being proactive about things, and then looking at climate change, that sounds like that's going to be really a reactive.
Well, first, let me start with your second point because it allows me to be philosophical. In the discussion on mainstreaming migration and development, we've made the point in the discussion last week that too much of this is seen as how do we use migration for development? And not enough is being seen, not enough is said about how to make development result in a more sensible migration policy. So I think that there is a two-way traffic and it has to be looked at more. However, whatever we do in the short run is not going to make a big difference. And this short run may be 20, 30 years. First, we're not going to get optimal policies in any country. I'd like to know, even Singapore, which probably gets closest to overall optimal policies over a long time, I'm sure if we look carefully, we would find various things we could improve. And most countries are very far from Singapore in terms of optimal policy making. So in the real world, we'll have suboptimal policies for a long time. The issue isn't whether the policies are suboptimal. The issue is, can we make them a bit less suboptimal than they were? And I'm not putting any constraint on anyone who feels strongly enough can found a political party, take over a political party, and get a popular mandate and bring change. But if you don't do that, you can't criticize the governments which are doing it unless you think these governments really are very badly intentioned and don't have the social welfare of their citizens at stake. And there are some governments in this category, but most governments are not. Most governments want to do something about the political compromise, about improving welfare of their citizens, but they are constrained by the political game they play. They may make wrong judgments. They may be overly conservative in what would be accepted, but they are the ones taking the risk. When your hand is in the fire, you have a different problem than the guy whose hand is in the water telling the guy whose hand is in the fire what to do. So, let's have as much change as we can. And how do we get change? If a population universally wants something, especially in a democratic society, politicians will normally deliver. So the problem isn't criticizing the politician, it's criticizing the society. And if you want change, don't blame the politician. Change the mentality of the people in the society. I don't think that immigration reform failed in the U.S. because George Bush was not sincere and President Obama didn't want to do it. It's just that there were not enough voices in America that wanted it to happen. So those who don't like it should less criticize Obama and Bush and more criticize American society. And I'm only saying this because we're here. Equal criticisms or more could be leveled at Mauritius. And I'm very frustrated, too, at my Ministry of Home Affairs, who want to take a risk on anything. So I'm just trying to say that, yes, there is an issue. We need to look at development more. But because we only make slow progress, we have to therefore worry about sensible migration policies in the meantime. Let's come back then to your other issue of how do we assess if life has improved. It's a collective judgment. We're looking for governments that we've said, look, are you interested in doing something to improve the welfare of people? Some people have stepped forward. We have to assume they are sincere. And the test will be when we say you're willing to do A, collectively we need to decide. And as I collectively means first amongst the interested governments, but two, with the private sector and the civil society voices that have to be brought in. Do we collectively agree this measure will improve welfare? If collectively we agree, we go. If we don't collectively agree, then maybe it's more difficult to go. But I think in the end, it has to be a subjective judgment. But if collectively we're exerting that subjective judgment, I'm not sure we should be ashamed of it. And in all likelihood, the things we're looking at, almost everybody would agree. It has to be issues of improving the legal status of people. I'm sure that doing that, most people would agree, is going to improve welfare. It has to be giving more access to social services. It has to be giving more freedom of movement in and out of the country. Not, I managed to slip by the border once, but if I go out again, I may not come back. Therefore, I'm going to not go home, even though my mother is sick and I'd like to see her. So I think the areas where, once we get practical, I think these issues will address themselves. I don't think the problem is going to be so much. Is this really going to improve human welfare? Do governments feel that they are able to convince 50% or 52% of the population to support them in doing the changes needed? And this is where civil society, both through activism, but also research, knowledge, we're dealing with people. If people have founded fears, we should obviously respect that. If it were true that by liberalizing migration rules, the country would be destroyed, overwhelmed, its culture would vanish, we certainly would not want to see that happen. So we are not talking about founded fears. We're talking about unfounded fears. And in unfounded fears, hopefully, knowledge, information, dissemination will help to deal with these unfounded fears, together with activism that tries to rally people to look at what is best in them instead of the fears that are the worst in all of us.
The lady over there, Madam Lynn.
I'm Becky, Communications Director with Coptic Orphans. We're a nonprofit diaspora organization. And my question is about countries that are far from optimal or systems that are far from optimal. I heard you say that the challenge is bringing the civil society and the private sector and engaging them as equal partners, but the government is encouraging. What if the government is not encouraging? What if the government is limiting or stifling the civil society, as in Egypt? What approach then can be taken, or what apparatus can be, you know, employed at this stage to then help the civil society do their job and, you know, spur development? Thank you.
I'd like to take one or two more questions because then we need to close. So here and then.
Thoughtwell with the American Council on International Personnel. And my association, I think, is unique around the world in that we work with large multinational employers on issues of high-skilled immigration. So we don't really have counterparts anyplace else, but we do work with business groups in other countries. I've participated in, I think, four of the GFMDs, and I have to say I think progress is being made slowly, but it is a challenge for me even to explain to my board and others why I participate in this. And it's because the agendas are so broad and the horizon is so far away that it's difficult to explain what we will accomplish by participating in these forums. I have to say I think there has been some progress made. I've been able to find the other few business people who are there and begin conversations with them on, you know, on an international level about where do we see this going over time. But I think to the extent that you can have forums within the GFMD that are very focused on particular issues, you'll be able to get broader business participation. Because when you start talking about all of, you know, when you start lumping together kind of labor migration with development, with climate change, it's very difficult for, I think, businesses to justify investing their time in these meetings. Because for most employers, I think for most companies, they're just now beginning to see kind of the importance of migration in the executive suite. It isn't something that's been on their radar screen for a very long time. It's getting there. I think more and more companies are seeing that this is a long-term challenge for them in finding workers both at the low and the high ends of the labor market. But it's not a top-tier issue for very many companies, and so getting them to participate is going to be difficult. I also have to say that, you know, when I do talk to civil society when I'm at these meetings, the most common question I get is, why are you here? So I think it's good. I think, as we look forward, I think we need to find ways to focus this. I thought the meeting in Athens, actually, that was smaller and more focused was very helpful. I thought some of the discussions last year in Geneva were focused. But, you know, when they start getting too broad, it's difficult for us to justify our participation. Thank you.
And over there, and then we'll send the floor, and that you can answer parts of questions and also make a closing statement.
It's a little easy. My question actually builds on this last question about the agenda. My name is Aphrodite Bouikidis. I work with Ashoka International. And I wanted to ask, to what extent at these gatherings is a focus on specific and concrete examples of solutions and collaborations that work, so that this understanding comes to place about how policy changes and different approaches can benefit civil society, the individual people, businesses, and governments. And I'm thinking we're just starting to look more closely at specifically the fellows in our global network that work with immigrant, migrant, refugee communities to understand how their solutions, like what their the common themes are, what's standing out that unites some of the and what the differences are in their approaches. And for example, there's one fellow that we looked at in France that is working with helping large companies connect to local entrepreneurs, and many of them being within migrant communities, for procurement, because the challenge was that it was difficult for large companies to procure from local suppliers and small businesses because of, I think, trust and accountability in terms of their own bureaucratic. Sometimes, like the own the businesses had difficult procedures for the local entrepreneurs to approach. So there were, you know, this is examples that can kind of bring together the different sides to understand what. How do you build that into the? How do you build that into your agenda to make sure that in discussing the issues, you actually get to the examination of these types of?
Let's start with what Lynn said, and I think this hopefully answers your question too. We have to have a practical agenda. As I said, right now we don't have substance, we only have process, which is both a plus and a minus. You know the story of the two salesmen who went into a country, the same country. One of them sent an email saying, back on the next plane, nobody wears shoes. The other guy said, send me all the shoes you can. Nobody wears shoes here. So we want you to be the second salesman. The advantage is that the territory hasn't been defined, and I go back. What we are asking governments is, you tell us where you think you can take action that would improve the welfare of migrants in your country. So first, governments will have to say what they think they can do, but then we'd like civil society to challenge governments, saying, we really think you've overlooked this important area, and it ought not to be all that politically difficult to do it, especially if we can get some the equivalent of the cohesion fund to help support building the political capital for it. So the agenda has to be defined, and it has to be defined around concrete, actionable things. We also have suggested, let's start with the private sector. The private sector needs to tell us two things. What rules they'd like changed in their own country for the migrants they already are dealing with, and two, what access would they like to have, because some of these companies are operating in more than one country, in other countries, so that their operations in those countries can be better. And this, together with what comes from civil society and government, hopefully we find actionable things. Our focus has been on a multi-year program of actionable things where we are accountable in that how many people's lives did we really improve for the better at the end of the year. We're proposing a 3-year pilot that, if it works, we can extend. It's an open platform, so more can join as we go along. Again, this may fail, but we hope we can build on some of the things which have worked. I don't think we're reinventing the wheel. We're just building on the work which has been done, but trying to focus it a little bit more. And our focus is Africa, only because we're an African country and we don't have the global reach of Switzerland or Sweden or the US. But we would like, if you can help, orchestrate things in other parts of the world. And the first question, the Global Forum on Migration and Development is states deciding they want to get together on a voluntary basis. So if it's a voluntary basis, it's first they will only do things which they want to do. Not everyone will do everything, but anyone will only do the things which they want to do. So countries which don't want to do anything, this is not the place where you'll get them to do it. Maybe you need a revolution to make them do it, which is not our job. I'm glad there were revolutions, and I suppose most people are, in North Africa. But this is not the problem of the Global Forum. So I think, again, let's not make the best enemy of the good. Not because we can't achieve everything we'd like to achieve, we give up achieving the small things we can. If we can do small steps and make real progress, we can build momentum over time. And this is an important area because migration has been with us from the beginning of history. And in a world which is becoming ever smaller, migration becomes ever more important as an issue. And going back to the previous point I made, we need to think both about how migration can contribute to development, but how development can contribute to better migration. There's a very healthy migration that nobody complains about, to my knowledge, between the industrialized countries. I've never heard anybody say there are too many Americans in Europe or too many Europeans in America in terms of skilled people deciding to live in different places because it's interesting career opportunities. So I think the notion that people only move because conditions are bad in their country is wrong. At the same time, it's true that too many people are forced to move because in too many countries, the dream of Martin Luther King is not being adhered to. We don't judge people by what they know and who they are and the strength of the character. Very often we judge them by the birth certificate they have. And this, of course, is a big driver to push people to countries which are more ready to apply what Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela said we should. So I'm not denying there's also a problem there. But I think migration is we need a healthy migration, which everybody would see as a plus, because human beings make a choice which is personal, not because they are forced to by circumstances. But that doesn't mean we'll get there in one day. But this improving development policies is important. And when we talk to the private sector, I suspect one of the things which will often come out is, in addition to anything specific on labor, you have to do something to improve the overall business climate, which is part of then people will not have to move because there will be more jobs at home.
Thank you for a magisterial performance, Ali, from Kings and Eklund to Nelson Mandela. I mean, you know, I think you have covered just about everything in between. It has been a pleasure to have you here and to see you again after so many years. Good luck with the EU. I do think that you, and you probably know that you will probably receive a good hearing on the part of at least some of the director generalships over there, because they do want to do something in Africa, and there's typically funds that can be found in that regard. And I think it is a very, very fortunate thing that Sweden is going to hold the chair both during the high-level dialogue, also do the you know, the Global Forum meeting that will emerge out of it the year following that. These are issues that Sweden cares deeply about, as you know. So you will have an opportunity to see, you know, some of the things that you're trying to accomplish being pursued more systematically, and have a year or two during which they can bear some more fruit than perhaps other initiatives have taken, have been able to move forward with in the previous Global Forums. And thank you very much for coming out on such a hot day and on a Friday to join us for this conversation.
But if you allow me, I just like, because I said homework at the beginning and I want to leave with homework. Many of the questions you've asked, the answer is with you. If there's time, is there time for a final story?
Of course, please.
A final story. and then the homework.
The stories are so compelling, I dare not say no.
There was a village in Africa with two mischievous teenage boys that you would find in any country, who decided that there was a man who was considered very wise by the whole village, and they would show everybody he wasn't as wise as they thought. So they cooked up this foolproof plan. They caught a bird, and on market day, when everybody would be in the center of the village, the elder boy would hold the bird behind his back. The younger boy would ask, "Do you know what my friend has behind his back?" Probably the guy wouldn't be able to guess, and he'd be seen to be a fool. But in the unlikely event that he did guess, the trick question, is the bird dead or alive? Depending on the answer, the bird would be allowed to fly, or its neck would be wrung and produced. So they put this plan into action, and the younger boy said, "Can you tell me what my friend has behind his back?" And the old man looked, and he saw a few feathers around the feet, and he said without any hesitation, "I believe he has a bird." They were a bit taken aback. Maybe this guy isn't as foolish as we thought. But they were ready, so the trick question. And the old man then said, looking in the eyes first of the young boy and then of the older boy, "The answer to that question, my young friend, is entirely in your hands." And I think the answer to whether or not we make this work and the questions you've had yourself depends on you. What I would like to leave you with is, you know what we're trying to do? As I said, it's unfortunately at this stage more process than substance. Can you help us get the substance? We said governments will have to define what are areas where, if to answer the question which was posed, how would we know whether we're improving human welfare? So it's your answer. Where do you think we can improve human welfare? We're asking you to help us focus on Africa, not because we don't want to worry about anywhere else, but this is where we can actively play a role as an African country, and we have partners who say they want to work with us on this in Africa. Whatever we do in Africa can then be taken elsewhere. But and if you can do other things in other regions, we encourage you. But for Africa, help us identify where are the areas you think, based on your own knowledge and work, we could make meaningful progress to improve human beings' lives. Migrants' lives, but migrants as human beings. And tell us what you think is feasible. Don't give us things which are going to be rejected by governments as over-demanding. Find things which you think are workable and make suggestions how to make it workable. Be sensitive to what political capital is going to be required to be spent and how that political capital can be generated either within the same groups or elsewhere to make it politically feasible. If you can do that, then I think you will greatly help us answer positively the questions you asked about whether this thing can work or not and whether it really can make a difference or not. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you very much. And just as a means of showing our spirit of cooperation and common interest here, if you have some ideas on, you know, how to move forward on some of the issues that Ali put on the table, you can send them to migrationpolicy.org. Of course, you can always enter the website of the Global Forum and do the same thing. And once more, the video of this event, as well as other information about the Migration Policy Institute, can be found at www.migrationpolicy.org. And we hope to see some of you on June 26th at 10:30 a.m. Because if you show up at 10:30 p.m., who knows? Have a great day. Thank you.